left them there. You can take them away, and we will, as usual, put it on Facebook and advertise by CBC Radio as well. So, Richard, would you come and share your material with us?
Well, thank you very much, Pastor Finney. I really appreciate this opportunity. I'm not here to drum up business. I'm here to serve the community and give you some information and perhaps also be of assistance to you. I'm here with my son, Joe, today. He got out of school early, and he said, Dad, I'll come down here and help you. He's going to pass out some information, and, you know, we're all getting older. And as we get older, we think of powers of attorney, and we think of last wills and testament. And as we get older, you know, the physicians, if they examine you and they determine that you shouldn't be on the road, they have the authority to notify the registrar of motor vehicles who can pull your license. And there's a story of one old gentleman. He was getting up there, and I guess he hadn't had his last checkup with the physician, and he got onto the highway, and as he was driving down the highway, he received a frantic phone call from his wife. And his wife said, honey, I just heard on the news there's a car going down the highway. There's one car going down the highway in the wrong direction. Please be careful. The husband answered back, one car? There's hundreds of them. Anyway, I'm a lawyer here in Rossay, and all the lawyers in Rossay are good lawyers. I believe there's four lawyers, and we're all rather kitty-corner to each other, so take your pick. And but I'm here to explain about wills and powers of attorney, and right off the bat, I find that people confuse those two documents. You have last wills and testaments, and you've got powers of attorney, and they're not the same. And to illustrate this point, if we were to draw a line right down through the congregation here, and we'll say, this side here has passed, and we'll call this line death. And I'm sorry I had to choose you folks. You folks now are under the ground. You folks here are still above the ground. But you're getting close to that line. The document that operates for you folks is called the Last Will and Testament. The power of attorney has no bearing on you. The purpose of the Last Will and Testament is one purpose and one purpose only, mainly. It's to give away your property, which you still own, even when you're in the ground. For you folks, the power of attorney is not meant to give away your property. It's when you're still in the land of the living, but close to that line, it's to appoint somebody to make decisions for you if you become mentally incompetent and can't make decisions for yourself. For you folks here that are under the ground and you've all got last wills and testament, and the last will and testament, the purpose is to give away your property for you, which you still own when you're in the ground. The person who gives the property away for you is your executor. The terminology power of attorney has no bearing on you folks when you're in the ground. But, and the terminology executor has no bearing on you folks when you're still in the land of the living. The person who makes decisions for you is the person you call your attorney. Your attorney is not your lawyer. in this case. Your attorney is the person you appoint to make decisions for you if you're in your hospital bed and you can't make them for yourself. You folks, maybe you have a power of attorney, but once you cross over this line into the land of death, the power of attorney becomes a meaningless, irrelevant document. It has no more power and effect. By the same token, you folks, when you're still in the land of the living, you've got a power of attorney, and maybe you've already written your will. But the will is just a document that stays on the shelf, and it doesn't do anything. You could say the last will and testament comes alive when you cross over this line. And you might say that the power of attorney dies when you cross over this line. So, last will and testament, power of attorney, executor is the person who gives away your property, which you still own when you're in the ground. And your attorney is the person that you appoint and you give them the power to make decisions for you if the day comes that you can't make them for yourself. Now, for both of these documents, both of which are important legal documents, both of which they have to be drafted in a very particular way, both of which they have to be signed in a very particular way, it can't be done willy-nilly, although you can try. They're important legal documents, and the laws of our land will respect what you've put in there if they're properly drafted, if they're properly signed, if they're properly witnessed. If they're not properly drafted, if they're not properly signed, and if they're not properly witnessed, the laws of our land will consider them to be invalid. Now, for you to be able to put your signature on any document, would it be fair to say that you have to know what you're doing? Would it be reasonable to expect that you understand what it is you're signing? So there comes a point in time when all of us, it'll be too late to have a will, if we haven't got one already. It'll be too late to prepare a will. It's going to be too late to prepare a power of attorney because our mind is going to become feeble. The Bible says, comfort the feeble. And the feeble are people whose minds are feeble. They're slow. They're not quite sure what it is. And you can't come before a lawyer and the lawyer says, here, sign here. In fact, when you go in front of a lawyer, you need to be able to tell the lawyer what it is that what you want. You need to be able to tell the lawyer what's in that document. He's not telling you, you're telling him. And based on your instructions, he's drafted what you've given him. And then maybe one last time, he'll ask you, who do you want to be your attorney to look after you if you become mentally incompetent? And then if you're husband or wife or your child is next to you, they can't put words in your mouth. You need to be able to tell your lawyer that. And same, he might say, who do you want to leave your property to when you cross over this line into the land of death? And it can't be your husband or your wife or your son or your daughter who tells the lawyer what you want. You have to be able to instruct your lawyer. So your lawyer is not going to take your signature on a document if you don't understand what's in that document, if you can't properly instruct the lawyer, because the lawyer has a duty. The lawyer has a client, and you're the client. not the beneficiaries, not the husband, not the wife, not the son, not the daughter, but you're the client. And the lawyer's duty, technically the lawyer's only duty is to the client. And if the client cannot properly instruct the lawyer, he can't take your signature on that document. So the moral of that story is, don't leave it too late, because there'll come a point where you will not be able to have or make out a last will and testament. You won't be able to draft or have a power of attorney, because you won't know what it is you're signing, and a lawyer will not take your signature on a document if you don't know what it is you're talking about. Got it? Okay. So I don't know what else there is for me to say. But anyway, the last will and testament is the document whereby you give away your property when you're in the ground. Everybody has title to the property. You've heard about title deeds, and you might say, I have title to the house. That's sort of the proof of ownership. And you have title to your car. That's proof of ownership. And this property is very important. So important, in fact, that your ownership is registered for your property, your house. It's registered at the land registry office. There's a title deed. It's got your name on it. It tells the date you got that property, the registration number of the deed, and it's conclusive proof that you own your house. And in fact, the world can go and look at that conclusive proof if they go to the land registry office. Every county in New Brunswick, there's 15 counties, every county has a land registry office. The land registry office for St. John County is in St. John. The land registry for Kings County is in Hampton. And every county has a registry office, and the world can go to those offices and they can look at that property. They can find out who owns it. They can find out if you've got a mortgage. They can find out if the Canada Revenue Agency has sued you for not paying your taxes, and everything there is to know. And I guess in a way, there's not many secrets. In the last will and testament, in this document, you give away all your property, and you name the beneficiaries that you're going to give it to. You might say, for example, if you're a wife, I leave it all to my husband, if he's living. And the husband might say, I leave it all to my wife, if she's living. No use giving it to your husband if he's already dead. He doesn't need it. And no use giving it to your wife if she's already dead. She can't use it. So in a way, you might say a last will and testament is kind of like a crystal ball, and you're trying to anticipate anything that could happen in the future. I'll leave it to my wife if she's living. I'll leave it to my husband if he's living. But if my wife isn't living or if my husband isn't living, then I'll leave it to my children, maybe. Maybe. You never know. You might say, I leave it all to my husband if he's living. But if he's not living, then all to my children. And then the husband dies. And she goes out and remarries. Marriage invalidates the will. They own everything jointly. Then she dies. And then the new husband gets it all, and his children get it all. That's not at all what she had in mind. She was kind of hoping to look after her own children. So anyway, I suppose maybe the moral of that story is that we've got to do these documents in a timely manner. While we still have the mental faculties to do them, if there's a remarriage, that invalidates the will you've already made. But in general, these wills will look like this. I leave all to my husband, if he's living. But if he dies before me, then all to my children, usually in equal shares. I've got three children. I want it divided by three. And the husband's will, usually, will be a mirror will. I leave it all to my wife, if she's living. But if she dies before me, then to my three children, for example, in equal shares. And then the question, and my three children are, what are the three children's names? Mary, Joseph, and Peter. And it just so happens that Mary is married, and Joseph is married, and Peter is married, and Mary has three children, and Joseph has three children, and Peter has three children. And you write your will today, and you say, well, all to my wife if she's living, and if not, to my three children, and the wife dies before you. So it's going to go to the three children. But you're still alive, and time carries on, and one of the three children dies before you. The will usually say, if one of my three, so if my wife dies before me, I want it to go to my three children. If one of my three children dies before me, I want their one-third share to go to their children. So if Mary had three children, her one-third share will be divided into three shares, and the other two children will get the other two-thirds. So usually, that's the way, usually, not necessarily, but usually that's the way these wills are drafted, and it's your way of looking after your family, looking after your wife or your spouse, looking after your children, and looking after your grandchildren. But that's not always the way it goes, because every situation is different. I can't tell you, you know, families are, families are, you know, that's one of the toughest challenges of life is the family and how to keep the family together. I don't know, can't tell you how many people come to my office and, you know, one of the children is missing in action. They just wandered away, they faded away, they're gone. We don't know where they are. Or sometimes parents, as they get older, you know, they've been giving all those years, and they're old and feeble, and they're hoping that the children will start giving them back, not in money, but they want a little bit of attention. They want a little bit of affection. You know, if there's nothing else, there's got to be affection between husbands and wives, and there's got to be affection between children and parents. And sometimes parents will say, you know, I haven't heard from that date. That child moved out to Edmonton in 1982, and I haven't heard from them these 30 years. And I've heard they're doing well, but they don't write, they don't send cards. I'm not going to leave them anything. I guess that's called cutting them out of the will. And hopefully that won't be a case. There's another case where people might not give an equal share to their children. You know, we live in a strange times. I don't think there's anything new under the sun, but things change in their intensity. And one phenomena of our society is drug addictions. And you have young people that are addicted to drugs, and sometimes people have a child, and they're thinking, I want to take care of my child. My husband and I have spent a lifetime accumulating wealth so that we can look after the next generation. But we know if we leave the one-third share to this child who's addicted to drugs, it'll be gone overnight. And sometimes parents will say, I think maybe what we'd like to do is keep that child's share invested for them and pay them out of the capital, or pay them out of the interest of the investment, keep the capital invested, and then when they pass on, which probably will be early because they're going to damage themselves with drugs, we'll leave the nest egg, the capital, to their children. Anyway, there's all kinds of variations, and whatever you can think of, you can do, but the goal is to leave your property to others when you're dead, because when you're dead and in the ground, you cannot go to the land registry office and sign the deed deeding the property over to somebody else. And you can't go to the bank, or your beneficiaries can't go to the bank and say to the Bank of Nova Scotia, give me all Dad's money. Well, Dad might be dead, but his name is still on the account, so there has to be an executor who does that. For the power of attorney, no use signing a power of attorney when your mind is so enfeebled that you can't come in front of your lawyer and properly instruct your lawyer about what you to do. Most powers of attorney will read like this: I appoint my wife or my husband to be my attorney, to look after me and make decisions for me when I'm in my bed of sickness but can't make them for myself. But it could be that my wife is going to become, or my husband will become, so old and enfeebled that they can't make those decisions for me, in which case, usually these wills will read, I appoint an alternate. You know, I have three children, and one seems to be, one's got the time and the motivation to go down to the hospital and tell the doctors and the nurses what to do with me. I think I'll appoint that daughter. And she's compassionate, too, and she doesn't like it when I'm in pain. My son, you know, boys are so impervious sometimes to pain. They don't care about that sort of thing. But daughters, they don't want you to suffer. So anyway, you'd want to choose the attorney wisely, but usually you'll choose your spouse if your spouse is still living or unable to do it. But if not, then I appoint my daughter or my son as the alternate attorney. And that... When the ambulance is taking you to the hospital and there's a sleet and snowstorm coming down and it's nighttime and you can just see the ambulance lights and they arrive at the St. John Regional Hospital and you park in the parking lot up top and you go down those cement stairs and you find your loved one in a gurney there. They've been there for 2 hours. And the doctors don't know what to do with the person, and the nurses don't know what to do. But you, the attorney, you come up waving your document, the power of attorney. The doors swing open wide, and the doctors and the nurses listen to, what do you want us to do with that person who happens to still be alive? So that's the power of attorney. That's the last will and testament. That's the attorney. That's the executor. And you probably have lots of questions, such as, what if I die without a will? And you probably have more questions, such as, what's all this business I hear about probate? Do I have to get the will probated? And you probably have questions about, what if I want to change the attorney that I've appointed in my power of attorney document, and I'm not too old to make that decision? What should I do? So I've given you the basics. We've given you some handouts. Joe, did we give these fine folks a pen? Let's give them a pen, too. And service to answer any questions you may have. The lady in the front with the green, is that green or teal? What do they call that? Teal. In the teal vest. Go ahead. Yes. So the answer is, so the question is, if you have an only child, isn't that person automatically the executor? And keep in mind, for the last will and testament, we've actually been talking about three groups of people. We've been talking about the person who writes the will. They're called technically the testator. And we've been talking about the executor, the person we appoint to give away the property. And we've been talking about the beneficiaries, the person to whom the property is given. So you could appoint anybody to be your executor. You may not want to appoint your child to be the executor, for example, or the power of attorney. For example, if your child, this is going to put some variation on the theme here. Let's pretend power of attorney, and you appoint your child to be your power of attorney to make emergency decisions for you if you're taken to the hospital. And lo and behold, it turns out that your child is teaching English in North Korea. That could be a problem if there's an emergency down at the St. John Regional Hospital. And you might want to appoint somebody close to home. And for you, you don't have to appoint your child, but a child would be I think if it's an only child, I would think that would be a great choice. And also, the only child would be your beneficiary. That would be the obvious choice too. It has to be legal. Now, it has to be legal. And what does there need to be to make the will legal? And everybody's going to ask me about holographic wills. And I don't even want to get into it. What's a holographic will? Holographic will is a will written by hand. And the ordinary rules for the execution of wills do not apply with holographic wills. But still, mistakes can happen. And I will give you an example. I don't know if this is true, but this was the example from law school. A farmer was on his tractor. He was on one of these big tractors. And he's coming through the fence. It's coming through the gate. And it hits a big hole. And the tractor rolls over and cuts him right in two. And just as the life is ebbing out of him, he takes a rock and he scratches on the fender, all to mother, and he signs his name, and he dies. So in this story, I don't know if it's true, it could be true, that fender is brought in, and there's a court case. And that fender is brought in as an exhibit, and it's held up as his holographic will. It's his handwritten will. Holographic wills, if they're written in your own hand and signed in your own hand and dated in your own hand, they don't need to be witnessed. And I think so goes the story. And he wrote all to mother, scratched his name with a rock in the fender, signed it, and then he died. The fender was brought in as an exhibit. And this holographic will was contested because he did have a mother. But he was also in the habit of calling his wife mother. So nobody knew exactly who he wanted to leave it to. But normally, and I don't do holographic wills. You could do your own, but take your chances, and it's not recommended. Usually for a will to be valid, there has to be a testator, the person whose it's their will, and there has to be an executor, and there has to be beneficiaries, and it has to be witnessed by two witnesses, two subscribing witnesses. And then if you have a house, the house cannot be sold by the executor if there's not an affidavit by one of the witnesses. What is an affidavit? An affidavit is a sworn document. What does it mean to swear a document?
I will show you. Thinking of shirts.
Anyway. Okay. Okay.
So here we go. Thank you, sir. This is the Bible.
The Evidence Act of New Brunswick. Section 13 says that if there's an affidavit, which is a sworn document, the person who's swearing has to go in front of a commissioner of oaths. And lo and behold, just last year, my son, he applied to the government to be a commissioner of oaths. And if I have an affidavit to swear, I go in front of him. And he holds, I have this document, and it says in such and such a date, I saw this person sign her will, and she was present, and I was present, and the other witness was present. There's two witnesses. And then my son, Joe, will read this affidavit to me, and he'll say, sign here, and I'll sign. And then he'll say, put your hand on the Bible. And he'll say, do you swear the contents of this affidavit are the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, help you God? Just like in the movies. And I'll say yes, and then he'll sign. So on this affidavit, which is a sworn document, there's two signatures. The person of the signature of the person swearing the affidavit, and the person of, and the signature of the commissioner of oaths. Now, when the executor goes to sell the house, that last will and testament has to be registered. It has to be registered at the land registry office. Now, she would sign the deed herself, but she's in the ground. She can't sign it. So the executor is going to sign for her. How's the land registry office going to know who the executor is? It's in that will. And so that will has to be registered. And in the will, the land registry people, they learn about, okay, it's her land. Get it. She's in the ground. Got it. She has a will. Got it. There was an executor. The executor is going to sign the deed. However, the registry office will not accept the last will and testament for registration if it is not accompanied by that affidavit of witness that I was telling you about. The affidavit of witness is signed by one of the two witnesses who witnessed her sign her will. There has to be two witnesses in the room at the same time looking at her. Both of them see her sign. She sees both of them sign. It's a little ceremony right then and there in the law office. And then and only there, then it's her signature, the two witnesses' signature, an affidavit of one of the witnesses who swears that this was really truly what happened on such and such a date in such and such a place, then and only then will the Land Registry Office accept it for registration. And then and only then will her executor be able to sell her house and distribute the funds, the proceeds of the sale, to the beneficiaries that she named. And again, you're probably wondering, well, what if she didn't have a will? And I will do my best to answer that question. Are there any other questions before we get to that burning question? Yes, sir. So, a codicil is something we still talk about it, but we don't see it much these days. So, a codicil really stemmed from the days of, you're all old enough to remember this, remember the old typewriters, Underhill, and you'd put the paper in, and there'd be a carbon paper in there, and you'd try not to make a mistake, and if you make a mistake, you'd have to go again, and you'd type, 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 and then you'd have to bring the carriage back. So those wills were kind of precious, and you didn't want to make a mistake, and if you needed to change your mind and add a new will, or create a new will, you didn't want to retype the whole thing, so there was something called codicils that you could make an addendum, let's say, or make an addition to your old will, and it became part of your old will, but it had to be signed in the same way as before. Now, this gentleman used the word notarization, which is something that I haven't used for the last will and testament. Power of attorney needs to be notarized, but not the will. The will, there has to be an affidavit of execution of witness, which is not the same as notarization, but that's besides the point. So the procedure for signing a codicil to change your will is about the same. And frankly, I have a confession to make. I've never done one. I've seen them, but we don't do them anymore. And I'll tell you why. Because we're living in the age of computers, and we're living in the age of laser printers, and it's just so much easier, especially if you were a previous client. They come to me, I want to do a new will. I've saved the old will on my computer screen, I make the change, and I whip out a new will, and it's nice, fresh, and pristine. But the procedure for a codicil, which amounts to the same thing as a new will, but it's not a new will, it's the old will with something tacked on to it, is the same. If I understand it correctly, there has to be two witnesses to the codicil, just like there were two witnesses to the last will and testament. Anytime a will is involved, the witnesses and the testator have to be in the same room together. They have to look at each other, sign this, and then that codicil is added to the thing. But in this day and age, so to answer your question, it has to be properly executed, this codicil. And I've seen them. Not a lot, hardly any. I can only actually remember one that I've seen. And it was from somebody out in Kingston Peninsula, who was, I think it was her husband, and she was very aged, and she was living independently on her own past the age of 100. And the water must have been some good out there, because she was a healthy person to be on her own, washing her own dishes, sweeping her own floor, taking care of herself, and it was past the age of 100. So, might not have been the best answer, but that's what I gave you. You need a codicil, but in these days and age, this day and age, if you want to change your will, they just do a whole new will, because it's all on the computer screen, and it's so much easier, and it's nice and fresh and clean. And whatever you do, now you know there's an alternate. You could go to Staples, and they have these will kits. And I know there's sort of a cheapskate bone or a cheapskate gene in all of us, and we want to save some money, and I've heard about these will kits, and I'm not going to say they're not valid. But, you know, if you look at a will from a lawyer in New Brunswick, they all tend to have the same flavor to them. But if you get a will kit from Staples, man, I don't even understand those. And it looks like it was drafted for, you know, the jurisdiction of Las Vegas, Nevada, not for New Brunswick, Canada. So I think caution is advised. Usually when people get those will kits, they think, well, I'm going to give Fifi to my neighbor across the street. I'm going to give my shovel to the person who helped me in the garden, and I'm going to give such, you know, the farmhouse to so-and-so. And they feel the need to list every single thing, which in the wills we don't list every single thing. But they don't give it all away. And I might not be the best expert for drafting wills, but when I went out on my own, it was 2006, and I got an office on Germain Street, and lo and behold, the lawyer on the other side of the wall was a guy named Dwight Alibi, and he's dead now. And I think the last I had seen him, he was at one of these bar meetings we have, not the bar, but the bar for lawyers. And he had a walker, and he was just hanging on his last legs. And I do remember going to his office, and I said, you know, Dwight, I'm new here, and I don't really have a clue what I'm doing. And he said this, Richard, all you have to remember is in these wills, you've got to give it all away. And when you give it all away in a will, it's called the residue clause. I give the shovel. I give the Fifi, I give the cat, I give my shoes, the socks in the sock drawer, anybody can take them. But the residue, that's where the money is. That's the house and that's the bank account. I leave it to my three children in equal shares per stirpes. And that's giving it all away. Sometimes people, when they get these will kits, they think, well, there's Fifi. And there's the socks in the sock drawer. And what else is there? And they don't end up actually giving it all away. So in the will, a lawyer will contrive to make sure you give it all away. And it'll all be done. And the house will be sold. And the executor will open an executor's account at the Bank of Nova Scotia or at the Royal Bank or wherever, and that the proceeds of the sale will go into that executor's account, and then the executor will pay your just debts, not going to pay your unjust ones. They're going to only pay the just debts. They're going to pay your funeral expenses. What did Mark Twain say? The only things sure in life are death and taxes. They're going to pay your taxes, and the taxes are paid. The credit card is paid, the funeral home is paid, and now there's three children. And the executor will write three checks, equal shares, 1, 2, 3. And then the executor's account will have $0 in it. The children will have the money in their pocket, and everybody will go their way rejoicing, hopefully. Yes, ma'am. Well, my own feeling is you should have, so usually you'd appoint your husband if he's living or if he's able to do the job. I appoint my husband if he's alive or if he's not too old, but if not, a child would be an excellent choice. And the question is, well, should I appoint two children or three children? And and I'm going to side with one child. But parents always say to me, but I don't want to slight my children if I don't appoint them to be the executor. I would think a child would be very relieved. But anyway, whatever. Whoever is the executor is under a duty. And the name of the duty that the children, or the executor, whoever it is known as a fiduciary duty. And in our systems, our system of laws that we inherited from Great Britain. We inherited our laws. Are we okay with that? We inherited them from Great Britain. And they're good laws. It's a really, really good system of laws. And in this system of laws that we inherited from Great Britain, there's this concept of a fiduciary duty. And what is a fiduciary duty? A fiduciary duty is the highest concept of duty that our systems of laws can envisage. And what it means is that the executor who's under this duty, this fiduciary duty, has to be sure that not one red cent goes missing. And I often give the example. So you're driving down to pay the funeral bills. This is a better example for power of attorney, which is the same kind of duty. You're on the way to NB Power. They're in the hospital, and you're on the way to pay their power bill. You can't stop, and you go to the bank and withdraw $100 to pay the power bill. You can't stop at Tim Hortons for a cup of coffee with their money because you're under a fiduciary duty to make sure that not one red cent goes missing. Now, who will know? The power of the attorney or the executor, they have a second hat. It's called trustee. They're the trustee of somebody else's property. And the trustee, we call them the attorney or we call them the executor, but in a deeper sense, there's a legal term for both of them. It's called a trustee, and they're under this fiduciary duty. They have to give or be prepared to give an accounting of what they've done with the money. Now, in any financial ledger, there's two columns. There's money that comes in, and there's money that goes out. And in a modern banking system, it's so easy. It all goes into the executor's account, and you see the date that it came in. And then the trustee, a.k.a. the executor, a.k.a. the power of attorney, the attorney, writes a check. And the whole world can see where the money went. So back to this lady's question, should we have, can we name a child? Yes, you can. Should we name a child? I think that's a good idea. Why not? Should you name two children? You can, and many parents feel the obligation to do so. But then they both have to go to the bank together. And this child, he's working at Point La Pro, and this child, well, she's the mom and the kids are at school. It's going to be, logistically, it's going to create a few problems. But parents, and you know what I have found? Parents know their children. They know their children. And I find when they're in my office, I can see the brainwaves going. And I'll say, you know, it's a little bit more convenient if there's only one. And they'll say, no, I think we're going to have both of them on there. They know how the brothers and sisters operate. They know how they think. And if they feel the need for an extra layer of security that there has to be two signatures on the checks, that it's going to be inconvenient for the children. But in the case of the last will and testament, if there's an inheritance of $500,000, everybody's going to be highly motivated to get down to the bank and sign the checks and do what needs to be done. Are there any other questions? Yes, sir. No. No. Yeah. So, let's just pretend to illustrate the point. Somebody dies without a will. If you die without a will, the government has a will for you. And that will is called the Devolution of Estates Act. So the Devolution of Estates, I guess evolution is going forward, devolution is going that way. So if somebody dies without a will, the Devolution of Estates Act says, well, is there a widow? She gets some of the estate. And are there children? And how do we determine who the children are? Because some children might be dead. The law says you're supposed to follow the lines of consanguinity. Sang is French for blood. So you look at the bloodlines. And you trace the family tree. And you look for children. And if this child is deceased, you see if they have children. Because our system of law, which we inherited from Great Britain, we didn't get it from North Korea. It's not a communist system, it's all private ownership. Our system doesn't like property to be tied up in limbo. It's got to go someplace. And there's a good reason for it. If somebody owns property, they tend to want to take care of it. You know, you own your house. Chances are you're going to paint it, and you're going to mow the lawn. You know, they found in Cuba, you're a doctor, you're a plumber, you're a ditch digger, all the same wage. So nobody wanted to try very hard because what's the use? So that's why our system likes private ownership, because it encourages us to take care of our property. And I don't even know how I got on that topic. Anyway, lines of consanguinity. So usually these wills will say, I leave it all to my wife, if she's living, if not, to my three children in equal shares. And then it adds these two little Latin words, per stirpes. And we italicize those words, P-E-R space stirpes, S-T-I-R-P-E-S. And it says, if this daughter is dead, her one-third share, for example, is going to go to her children. And we're going to keep on finding a blood relative until we can give all that money away. Now, the question is, what if everybody dies in a plane crash? And that's interesting, because we here in the West don't really think like this. But the Asians do. And if they're going on a trip, sometimes they won't let the whole family go on the same plane. We're going to get different tickets. We're going to get different planes, different flights. Because they have genealogies there. They have a much deeper sense of the interconnectedness of generations. It's a big deal. Maybe not in modern China, but the old timers think that way. So It's probably not a good answer, but lines of consanguinity, and I guess if everybody goes down on the same plane, who cares? The government can have it, because if there's no children, if there's no relatives left, it's not going to make any difference to you. And I don't know if that ever happens, and that probably wasn't the best answer, but it's the best I can come up with.
When does the government actually get
it? They don't get it at all. Now, what happens? Well, they do get a sizable chunk. And here's how it works. The first paragraph of your will say, I ask my executor to pay my just debts and funeral expenses and all my taxes right up in the year up to the date of my death. And before your executor writes those last three checks to the three children, the estate has to pay the taxes. And the taxes in Canada are high. And it's going to have a serious impact on the actual amount that the children receive. Why are taxes so high in Canada? Because that's the government you've chosen. And you choose a different government, and they're not going to be the same. And let's just leave it at that. So the government is going to get a big chunk of your estate. The children, the beneficiaries, do not pay taxes on their inheritance. But when it comes out of the estate into their pocket, they have to pay taxes. And taxes are high. Commodity prices are high. And we say, you know, we don't really feel that. But, you know, there's tents going up in St. John. There's people living on the street there. And something's going on. In the a land of plenty with vast natural resources, vast mineral resources, the Canadian Shield, nickel, gold, silver, cobalt, iron, ore,
diamonds.
We've got young people living on the street. Shouldn't be like that in Canada, but it is. Wasn't like that when we were children, but it is now. We didn't. You know, there was alcohol, but something's changed. I was a soldier for many years, not in the Canadian Army. I'm a veteran of the French Foreign Legion, the sands of the Sahara, Chad, two times, Republic of Central Africa. And I've got to say, the mindset was tough. And the expectation that somebody's going to help you with anything was low. And the expectation upon yourself to do what needs to be done, regardless of the inconvenience, the physical inconvenience, the discomfort, was high. And there was nobody to dry your tears, and there was nobody to wipe your nose. And we survived. And you survived like that. You maybe have an inkling of what I'm feeling, what I'm talking about. The generation today, it doesn't seem like that. Maybe that's computers that have done that to us. I had my son when he was six out working in the woods and driving the ATV. It broke all the rules. Social services can't come and get me now because he's already 21. And how he survived, I didn't know. And he didn't know what work meant because he had no standard of comparison. But he brought in the wood. And he went out and got in the cold. And he had wet feet. And, I wanted him to be tough. But not all the children have that opportunity nowadays. They're, you know... There's TikTok and there's, you know, CRAP on the internet and everything. So times have changed. I don't know how I got on that subject, but let's go on to the next question. Yes, sir. So what happens is the person dies and they own a house. They're in the ground. They still own the house. Their executor calls the real estate agent, REMAX, Exit Realtor, Realty, Royal LePage. The real estate agent comes and says, I'll be your real estate agent. Who owns this house? It was my mom or my dad. They're dead. Here's a proof of death certificate. The real estate agent says, well, who's, did they have a will? Yes, they had a will. Here's the will. Who's the executor? I'm the executor. And then the real estate agent says, good. We're okay. So they sign the agreement of purchase and sale. The ink is wet. They've agreed on the executor has agreed on the purchase price. And the agreement of purchase and sale goes to the lawyer. And the lawyer says, oh, this person is dead. Do you have an original will? And the executor says, well, no, I've only got a copy. I lost the original. That's the other thing. The land registry office will not accept a copy for registration. It must be the original. In consequence of which, I always ask my clients to sign the will in blue ink because copiers are so good nowadays, you can't tell. So there must be the original will. And the executor says, man, I made 10 copies and I gave one to the accountant, one to the bank, one to the funeral parlor, and I lost the original. Do not lose the original will. Because the land registry office, besides that affidavit of execution, they will not accept the will for registration without an original will. So the executor gives the original will to the lawyer. The lawyer prepares another affidavit. It's called an affidavit in proof of death, which the executor signs. And attached to that affidavit of proof of death is a funeral director's proof of death certificate from Bernans or from Reed's or from Kennepakasis Funeral Home. And all that goes into an envelope, and the lawyer calls Purolator or UPS or FedEx, and he ships it down to St. Stephen. He ships it down to the land registry office in St. Stephen, and they take that original will and they register that will, and they don't give the original will back. You never get the original will back. And the world can now go on to the property registration system, which you can't unless you're a subscriber, but I can. You can come to my office and I'll take you on. And you can now see that original will. They'll scan it. The whole world can see that original will. It's been registered, and the land registry office keeps the original will, and you never get it back. It works in multiple counties. No. Only here. So if they've got property here, their property will be sold here. And the question is, well, what if they have property in Quebec also, or Nova Scotia also? Well, that's never happened to me. I don't know the answer to that question. But I do know how I would deal with that question. And let's talk next, hopefully, about probate. And then that'll be easier for me to answer that question. But anyway, the original will has to be registered, and you never get it back. And then the world can go on to the land registry database, and they can see that original will. I was looking at one of those today, just today. Any questions about probate? What is probate? Okay, good. So, probate, to understand the word probate, it helps to know the meaning of the word probate. And when you think of the word probate, it might remind you of another word in the English language called reprobate. Reprobate is bad. So if reprobate is bad, probate must be good. And what probate is a court. We have a court. It's part of the Court of King's Bench. And it's called the probate court. And with probate, you take your will and you present it to the Court of King's Bench through an application. It's called a probate court application. And basically, the court gives this will a stamp of approval and say, this will is properly made up. It's properly executed. It can be accepted, and nobody should look sideways at it. The way the court does this is that it says, we've seen the will, in consequence of which we're going to issue something to the applicant, which is almost always the executor. And what is issued to the executor is something called letters. The court issues a document called letters, letters probate. And in these letters probate, the court says, this is the executor, and what they say goes. And now, at the land registry office, what's being registered is these letters probate. And what's being shown to the bank is these letters probate. It's like a court order. And when you give a court order to the bank that's signed by a judge, the doors swing open wide. We're not going to ask any questions. We're not going to give you a hard time. You want the money? You take it. You want that house registered? No problem. So that's probate. Does every will need to be probated? You know, in a way, I don't think hardly any will should be probated, but we're living in a day and age where you see wills probated all the time. And why probate, in my mind, seems to become an issue almost all the time is because somebody dies, they have a last will and testament, the executor goes to the bank and says, I'm the executor, here's the will, give me the money. And the bank looks at them and says, no, you've got to get this will probated. And I think the real reason why they do that, in fact, I heard this from a banker once, it's just to protect ourselves so that if we give all the money to the executor and it turns out this will is a flawed will, we're not going to be in trouble. And so increasingly now, banks are saying to the executive, you've got to get this will probated. And it's no big deal. People have been coming to my office and saying, man, somebody told me this is going to take 6 months. And my batting average in general, if everybody cooperates, is 2 weeks. But we get the will probated. It comes back with the letters probate. I give that to the executor. And It's a document with the stamp of the court on, the signature of a court official, and everything becomes easy. But technically, it shouldn't be necessary, and I think it's banks that require. I think often what happens also with banks is you give your money to a bank, TD or Royal Bank or Bank of Nova Scotia. They all have an investment arm. TD has Royal Dominion Securities. TD has TD Wealth. Royal Bank has Royal Dominion Securities, Bank of Nova Scotia has their investment arm, and they take your money, and when they give it to this third-party investment arm, in general, for almost in my experience, that third party, and the executor comes along and says, I'm the executor, so-and-so is dead, give me the money. That third-party investment arm will not release their grip on that money without the will being probated and an order of the court sort of ordering them to release it. I find that's why. But ultimately, it's just a way of having the court look at the will and say, this will is valid, it's good, and you release the money to the executor, you have nothing to fear. It won't come back to haunt you. Yes, it does. Now, one shouldn't be alarmed at that, because we hear about wills being contested, and people are afraid, is the will going to be contested? If it's probated, it's like the court saying, don't bother contesting it because the will is good. But there is a cost to it, and here's the cost. When there's a probate application that goes to the court, the lawyer in his office with you will create an inventory of the estate. And they do that by looking at all the bank statements, all the investment accounts. They'll find out the value of the house, and they'll create this inventory, and they'll come up with the total value of the estate. For every $1,000 that the estate is worth, $5 have to be paid to His Majesty the King, which is the government of Canada. So if the estate inventory shows that the estate is worth $1 million, $5,000 have to be paid in probate court fees. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot. But the person has saved their money and sacrificed and taken care of their property, and I guess we have a duty to be careful with it too and not let any go to waste. But probably when mom and dad are gone, the children are just thinking of the money. And, you know, if they get $300,000, $305,000, $303,000, $302,000. It's like Monopoly money at that stage. They just, you know, give me the money and I'll take it. Anyway, sir, you had a question. Okay. Yes, ma'am. The money to pay for?
Like if it was $100, each one of the three children would get $33.
Right.
But he's already had to pay $10 to get that.
Ah.
Does he not get that?
Well, just a minute. Good question. So who's going to pay these probate court fees is the question. And the will says that my estate is going to pay my just debts, funeral expenses, and taxes. So what happens in the law, in the lawyer's office, they do this inventory of the estate, the lawyer creates a trust account summary, and the lawyer says to the executor, now you take this and go back to choose a bank, give me the name of a bank. You take this to the Bank of Nova Scotia and show it to them. And from the account of the deceased, they will write you a bank draft payable to your lawyer. And that bank draft will cover the probate court fees for every $1,005. And it will also pay the lawyer's bill. The lawyers don't do this for free. So the executor is not going to have to pay anything out of their own pocket. Don't worry about that. The estate is going to pay for everything. Yes, ma'am. Well, technically, yes. Now, let's talk about that. That's called a joint bank account. You all have joint bank accounts with your spouses, right? And if your spouse dies, who owns all the money in the account? You do. So that's technically, in the pure sense, that's what a joint account is. So in this lady's scenario, she said, I was getting on, let's pretend, I've added my daughter's name to the account as a joint account holder. So technically, when she dies, the daughter will own it all. Because that's what joint means, right? There's joint bank accounts. There's also joint ownership of houses. Husband and wife, both their names on a title. The husband dies. The wife doesn't own half the house. She owns all of it. They hold it jointly. Now, there is kind of a system going on at the banks, which I have not been personally involved with, where banks understand that the elderly are living. In fact, Pastor Finney, he gave the example of this gentleman. He was very old. He was infirm. And yet he was living independently. He had these pulleys and these ramps, and he was able to get on. But the banks are recognizing that old folks, as they called them in my day, they need some help. And they will often have a son or a daughter who the bank will put on the account and can sign checks for them and can do their banking with them, because they waddle into the bank with their cane. It's going to be difficult. And I don't know if that's the same as a pure joint account. But a pure joint account is, there's two account holders. Doesn't matter who put the money in there. Let's say mom put $1 million in there, and Junior has only put $1 in there. Mom dies, Junior now owns $1,001,000, as I understand it. And, you know, this would be a good time to have a banker come and supplement a lawyer. And even before the banker, it would be good to have an accountant. And I believe that Pastor Finney has done just that before. There was once I was here, there was a panel, there was a banker, there was a funeral director, there was a lawyer, there was an accountant. And that's a good idea. But don't worry. I will tell you what's going to happen. At the funeral parlor, they will come along with a checklist for you, and they will help you. They're going, I think, in my experience, they will anticipate your every problem, and they will anticipate your need. They can't conjure up a will if you haven't done that before you die, but they will help you with your taxes. They will help you with death benefits. They will help you with so much. And it just seems the funeral people are just perfect for that. So don't stress out about all the things that I'm telling you. Sir, you had a question.
Yeah. You were talking about joint accounts.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Yes. And it's your money. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And what did the probate court do? So there was the will, and it said, you know, divide it between the children, of which you were one. But the money in the bank, is that your money? Well, that was kind of you to do that, I guess. Now, what if, when your mother passed away, you would have said, it's all mine? Not that you do that. Now, and I see what's going on here. If you had them, it is all your money, because you're the joint account holder. It did, and that's just to get the will approved. And the will says divide it between the children in equal shares per stirpes or something like this. Well, it said something like that. And then, but the question is, what money did your mother own? Because usually a joint account is, let's say it's a husband and wife. If the husband dies, who owns all the money in the account? The wife. But well, let's say you've got a husband and wife, and the wife has been a housewife. She's been cooking and cleaning and. And let's say it's the husband who put the money in the account. He's put $1 million in there. And then the husband dies. Who owns all the money in the account? It's a joint account. The wife owns it all. How much money did she put in? Nothing. She didn't put any, and that's all that goes in the account. We get it. Yeah, I know. Let's not. Nobody's underestimating that. Good. So that's to me what a joint account is. Now, I think, sir, I know you're saying my mom did this as a convenience, so that I would help her with her bills and take care of her. But our understanding always was this is her money. And when she passes on, she has a will, and I'm her executor, and I'm going to do what the will says. So far, so good? And that's what you did. Now, if you hadn't have done that, you would have said, well, this is a joint account. My name is on the account. The other account holder has departed this life. It's all mine. Could anybody have stopped you? Exactly. But anyway, and I see this happens all the time. But I do think that banks have got into a new modified joint account to help in a situation like that. They realize elderly people are living independently longer, but they need the assistance of a son or daughter. So to help with all the rigmarole of banking, getting in the car, walking across the icy parking lot, they have a modified joint account to allow the son or the daughter to help the parent manage their money. And, you know, I'm not speaking with authority when I say that, but a banker will know. And I think there's something like that. And I think a banker will say, yeah, exactly what he's saying is right. We've got a different kind of a joint account. It's not the type that normally husbands and wives will have. It's for elderly people who have a child who's going to help them. And it's sort of understood that the money is not the child's. It belongs to mom. Do you know what I mean? I see I might be trespassing on Pastor Finney's time. He's just gotten out of his chair. He's trying to make his way down the aisle. Are there any last questions? You go ahead. Yeah. Okay. Say it again. Yeah. Mm. You know, I don't know. The Bible does say a wise man will leave an inheritance to his children's children. The question is, what is the inheritance we're going to be leaving? Is wisdom, character qualities such as diligence, such as endurance, such as honesty. Now those, you know, everybody wants their children. They come to my office and they say, I want to leave this for my granddaughter. I hope she gets an education. Well, it depends what education she's getting. They're not all the same nowadays. And people go in otherwise normal and they come in completely screwed up. Well, that's the big issue down at Columbia University. Tuition, $70,000 for 1 year for a freshman. And that's U.S. And these young people have never done a day's work in their life. They're disrupting classes. They're protesting. They're blocking things. They're scaring people. They're threatening violence. So it depends what kind of education they're going to get. But we do want to leave them with character qualities such as diligence, honesty, endurance, love, kindness, all those things. And that's a valuable inheritance. But money does complicate things. And is somebody going to destroy themselves with money? Suppose Junior takes mom into her home and cares for her for 20 years, should he get a little bit more than the other children? Or should it just be, well, just do it equally? This is where wise parents need to think long and hard about this, because money is a double-edged sword and it's hurt more people than it's ever helped. But you do want to help them. But you know what happens when people get a whole bunch of money for nothing? They never worked for it. They get lazy. They waste it. They get something for free and they don't appreciate. You know, I've always heard that, you know, you buy a young man a motorcycle, and he gets it for free, he's going to wreck it. He has to pay for it himself, through having worked odd jobs and after hours. He's going to shine it, take care of it, don't touch it, be careful with it. And that's just human nature. So parents need to be wise. Pastor Finney, thank you very much for this opportunity. You're a great crowd. You're all very bright-eyed, very smart, very attentive. And be wise. Pastor Finney, thank you very much, sir.
So that was excellent. Maybe have raised a few more questions. The banking one is interesting. I think maybe next time we do this, we'll bring a banker in, because I actually just signed my mother's bank account so that I could do exactly that same thing. And my understanding was the moment she dies that the executor then comes in and takes over all of those assets. But from a legal point of view, I'm not sure. Like, I know one of the things is I wanted to have access to her credit card. So I said, can you put my name on her credit card? And they said, yes, you can. However, that now becomes your debt as well. And so it kind of cuts both ways. But we went in and talked to the banker and took counsel from the banker as to how to best do this. And my mother just asked me like 3 months ago, would I now take over paying her bills? And so I'm doing that on her behalf now. I have full access to everything. And my sister had the same status before she passed away. But yeah, lots to think about here, Richard. Now, how many are going to go home and phone a lawyer now? I just a cautionary note. We did have somebody, I shared about this last time, who in this parish who passed away intestate without a will. I went before Judge Turnbull, and he said, I knew so-and-so, and I said, I'm sure that she had a will. And said, and he ordered me, he said, you will search diligently. It turns out Linda was going to search diligently. Until you've done an exhaustive search. So I hired Linda to go through how many banker's boxes? A lot of banker's boxes. And she found a holographic will. And so I could take that back to the judge, and he then approved it. I'm not sure if that was a proper probate thing, but he approved it. He said, yes, this is the will. Now I appoint you as the administrator, the executor or the trustee, whatever. He said, you have the full authority now to do this. I also had to engage a lawyer. Now, because this was a complex thing, the lawyer's bill was north of $20,000. Because, as we've heard here, it is a very complex thing. So do not die without a will, a proper one, with all the I's dotted and T's crossed. It is worth a lot to do that, as we found out. And it took a lot of time to process it, even though there was, the good thinking of having a will. It was a scrawled out, note on a piece of paper, and we had to go get her signature attested to that, yes, this was her signature. But that whole thing was a very costly affair. So thank you. There's more tea and coffee out there. You want to grab Richard's ear? I'm sure you can do that. So
I just want to say just a short note. I've known some people who say, I don't want to make a will, because if I make a will, I'm going to die. Well, here's the answer to that big secret. You are going to die. So you make a will sooner rather than later.
We often say nobody gets out of this life alive. So.
All right. Thank you all for coming.